And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
And welcome back to Chatter on Books. We are here ready to talk books. And by the way, just hearing...
And pictures.
And pictures. Everything, really.
And picture books.
And picture books. Yeah, you have a picture book with you today,
I do.
Michael.
It's my recommendation.
And I just want to say, hearing Tony's voice in the open, I know he is having a tough weekend and a tough day with some health issues. So we're just... Our thoughts are with you, boss.
Yeah, absolutely.
Our thoughts are with you.
But that makes it sound much worse than it actually is.
Yes. He okay. did do PTI today, did
yes.
he not? Yes.
Yeah.
So he's doing okay.
He's a gamer. He's a gamer.
Yes. But we brought a big crowd here.
Thank you
crowd.
For coming,
everybody.
Crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Very
thank you, AU.
About that.
Thank you, AU, for sending out people.
What? This AU's here?
David Aldridge.
My Eagles are here?
Yes.
All right.
I would say fly, Eagles, fly, but we've already discussed that that's not your slogan.
That's not our song.
Hit him high, hit him low.
I could sing the alma mater, but it would be very bad. Very bad.
A lot of exciting things going on today. What's the rundown today?
We're here with Michael Kornheiser. We're allowed to say Carol Kornheiser is here, but we're not going to put her on the mic.
Hi, Mom.
David Aldridge, Mark Stern, myself, Tori Clark, at Chatter on the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer Street. And our author of the evening, our creator of the evening, as I'm calling for tonight, is Pete Souza, who's
yes.
just an incredible guy.
Yes.
I was talking to some of the gang before we started here, and I said my husband had warned me because I was so excited about Pete being here. And I've looked at his book 1,000 times, and I said, I've got 50 questions for every page of the book. And Brian looked at me and goes, you really can't do that. You know, so I will be restrained. But we got a few other things on tap here. We have a book report from Mark Stern, who I thought we were going to have to ask for another extension, but he let us know today
Let's
that
clarify.
He's ready to go.
Let's clarify. There was no extension from last week, okay? I was under the impression I had a month to get this done, so I'm coming in 2 weeks early in my
that's
mind.
That's why you have okay. to listen to
only
your teacher
down.
When your teacher gives the instructions. That's why.
Okay. I don't listen to anybody.
We got a book report. We got a little bit. David was reading the Paris Review this weekend, which really impressed me. Books versus Bites.
It's really
in
weird that I was
in honor of President's Day, which it is. And some people have been here at Chatter celebrating President's Day all day long.
Love it.
Favorite books about presidents, and of course our deserted island recommendations. But I've got a couple of quick pop-ups. First of all, David, you have to help me. Manager Ron gave me the wine of the evening, which is actually the Prosecco of the evening,
okay.
which is in a very fancy bottle.
Are we guzzling from this?
You described that we're going to pop it in a second, but you describe the bottle, and I'll decide which of these many paragraphs I'm going to read.
It's a white bottle. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a very nice white bottle.
I hope I'm saying right. Zonin Prosecco. It's a sparkling Italian
extra
wine.
Extra dry.
Made from the Giera grape, which is native to... Oh, my God. There's so many words here that I can't read.
Exactly.
Which is native to the Veneto region. The Zonin family owns the largest Giera vineyards in Italy. I'm guessing that's G-I-E-R-A. I'm guessing that's a kind of grape. This control over all aspects of the production from vineyard to glass allows Zonin to produce the freshest Prosecco in the market. And it goes on to say it's lively and sparkling, which is essential to Italian style.
Looks great.
So there you go. Thank
you,
Ron.
The bottle almost looks like it's a bottle of Malibu, except there's no... Sunset.
Nice,
and a palm
nice
tree
comparison.
On it.
Yes, you can do that.
Yes.
Maybe Ron can pop that for us in a little bit later. Mark, in addition to finishing his book report this weekend, was reading the Washington Post and saw a very fun, interesting piece by Ron Charles, who's a crazy book critic for the Washington Post. Some of them, God bless them, I'm sure, are very smart and very talented and rather dry. And Ron Charles does these crazy videos about books, and he's nuts, but he had one
good way
yesterday in which he had about 20 books in which he talked about last lines
yeah,
of
the closing
book.
Lines
and the significance of the closing lines. Did you have any favorites?
Well, I'm an Orwell guy, so I love there were two that I loved. The Orwell and he loved Big Brother
right,
because at that moment you're like, oh wow, they won, wow, they really won, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert.
Cowboys
and then
won again.
And I love, and I'm going to, I don't want to butcher the closing line. Michael, I think you know it.
So we beat on.
Yes.
Boats against the current. You can take it from there.
No, I can't. My mind
Born
is
back ceaselessly into the past.
Yes. Gatsby.
There you go.
Gatsby? When you stick the landing, when you get that last line, and there's a lot of great ones on that list. But
I thought it was the Shecky Green story, no?
that was also.
I realized looking at the piece, there were a lot of these famous books which I've read and never finished, like Lord Jim. Okay, pop quiz. Here's the last line, David. Are there any questions?
I read this yesterday. I read it, and I'm going to say Gone with the Wind until you read Gone with the Wind.
The Handmaid's Tale.
Damn it, yes.
Okay,
damn.
Okay.
Damn. Not mine.
Let's see. This was my favorite. It is not often that someone comes along who is a true friend and a good writer. Charlotte was both.
Charlotte's Web.
Charlotte's Web.
Yay! Very good. Okay, last one. But I reckon I got to light out for the territory ahead of the rest.
Ah, come on. We know this. Huck Finn.
Huckleberry Finn.
God, good for you. See, I never read the answer.
You missed my favorite one.
Clearly. Which one?
And it was still hot. Oh, where the wild things are.
Oh, yes. Excellent. I saw that on TV this weekend.
The night Max wore his wolf suit and made mischief of one kind and another.
Excellent. Well, I really recommend that to people. It's Ron Charles. It was in yesterday's Washington Post. He had about 20 of them, I guess, and just a really interesting take.
He includes the last line from Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I encourage you, if you've never read the book, find the book on audiobook because it is read beautifully, and that last chapter, chapter 20, is breathtaking.
Well, and speaking of ends, I think I may have said this last week when we had Dan Pink on. I really recommend you read that book called When, which he talked a lot about last week.
Fascinating.
But if you can't read the whole book, read page 218. He sums up the whole thing on page 218, and I've taken it out, and it's on my refrigerator now. Okay, enough of pop-ups. Professor Kornheiser, would you like to lead us into this segment?
So we are waiting for the book review from young scholar Mark Stern, who has prepared a few thoughts on his impressions from The Virgin Suicide. So I'm actually going to let him open with his impressions, then we'll go from there.
Thank you, Professor. Okay, so The Virgin Suicides is the book I was assigned a couple weeks ago by Jeffrey Eugenides. And it was also made a movie, which, by the way, I did
still on the Wikipedia opening paragraph, just so you know.
I did not watch the movie.
The way in which you're saying that, your eyes are getting big and your hands are waving around, I think you're lying. But go ahead.
You think I just watched the movie? No.
That's what I would have
done. All honesty, I went a combo of audiobook and Kindle. And so I kind of covered it that way. I would have the audiobook as I went to sleep. And then I would obviously miss a lot. So then I would read and catch up on that. That's how I attacked it.
Perfect.
I had a two-front attack on this. So this is the story. It's set in Michigan, Grosse Pointe, Michigan, in the, I guess, in the late 70s. And it's the story of the Lisbon family and their five daughters. And it opens up with the suicide of one of the daughters. And it without spoiling it, but I'm going to spoil it, it ends up sort of telling the story of the suicide of the other four sisters over the course of the next year. And it's told in a very interesting way. It's beautifully written. The subject matter is a little tough because you're talking about teen suicide. You know, it's not something that's, this is a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But it is beautifully written. And he captures a lot of the mindset of being a teenager in that time. It is told from the viewpoint of a bunch of the boys who lived in that neighborhood who sort of watched the sisters sort of decline into their spiral into the suicide and in the interactions with them. They were classmates. And and I read a little bit of some critique on this, and they say, well, it was partially sort of done in the style of the Greek Chorus. They're telling the story, but they sort of, unlike the Greek Chorus, they interact with the actual characters of the story. So it's an interesting take on that. It's fascinating in one sense because they're doing this. They're sort of doing an investigation as to why the girls all killed themselves. And
who they? The boys.
The boys.
Okay.
The nameless, faceless boys. The Greek Chorus, so to speak, and they're doing it with the benefit of time. And one thing struck me, because they'll introduce a character and be like, oh, here's Mrs. such and such. And then they'll do a quick aside and, you know, she, you know, got divorced or died or something like that. And so you know her future before the character knows it. And it reminded me, did you ever read a book called The Rumor of War by Philip Caputo?
Missed that one.
It's about the Vietnam War. And he would do the same thing as he was introducing people as he was going through, you know, boot camp. He's like, and there was Sergeant, you know, Shriver or whatever, and, you know, he would step on a landmine 6 months from now. So you sort of, it's weird that you know the fate of the characters before the characters actually themselves know it, which is, it's a great sort of conceit to write from, I thought. And it's, again, it's beautifully written. The ending of it is very ambiguous. They never sort of find out why the girls killed themselves.
Professor Kornheiser, questions?
I think Mark's done a great job with this so far. What I appreciate is, so I like to sprinkle a few what I would call signposts if I'm teaching this. So a few of those would include, I want you to consider suburbia. I want you to consider plants. In this case, following the trees and the demise of the trees really follows where the girls are. As you're looking at, say, even the neighborhood, we are in the suburban world. We're at a crossroads where we're moving past this post-war, the post-war ideals, and this family's at that crossroads where we're then moving into the 80s, 90s, the excess. We have looser morals and standards for family life, and you really see that with the girls because the mother in particular keeps them under lock and key. They're not allowed to date. She really watches over what they wear, and that leads to some of the exploration that the girls then then decide to embark on, or at least one of the daughters. And that also includes the boys as they study these girls as if they are a sexual experiment that they need to break apart piece by piece. And if you remember a few weeks ago, we read the opening paragraphs where we were looking at the summer of the fish flies.
Yeah.
And the fish flies come, and the half-life, the amount of time these fish flies are allowed to spend in this community or on this earth as they overwhelm the cars and you have to sweep them down the sewers, really begins to look a lot like the girls themselves. What do we allow them to do? And I really like that the look into the chorus, the look into the community at large. What do the teachers do? What do the other adults do? How do they treat the rest of the family when they've been when they have fallen prey to suicide and to tragedy with the family? Are they going to help them lift them up, or are they going to let that house, that whole family, fall into disarray? And you see that. One of the things Mark came when we were talking earlier was he started to notice the house, the yard.
Oh,
what
yeah.
extension of a family do you see when the yard's no longer cut, when the paint's beginning to chip, when people aren't taking care of some of those appearances? When I return to this, and I'm struck by our inability to move past or to see past the filter that our neighbors put on. I'm interested in terms of Mr. Souza's work, just because I think about the way we all put a filter on our own lives right now, whether that's through Instagram or through the perfectly curated Pinterest page or the way we present our house.
Yeah.
So I wanted to end with just a paragraph from one of the last few pages. This is on 241. And again, I left Mark with the idea of paradox and ambiguity, because we enter with a mathematical question. The boys want to solve for X. We understand what happened. We want to know why. And one of the things Marx was focusing on earlier was, do the boys try and take blame away from themselves? Do they want to remove themselves from that equation to see if they still get that neat, simple solution? Why did this happen? Again, we're on the middle of 241. In the end, we had pieces of the puzzle, but no matter how we put them together, gaps remained. Oddly shaped emptiness mapped by what surrounded them, like countries we couldn't name. All wisdom ends in paradox, said Mr. Buell just before we left him on our last interview, and we felt that he was telling us to forget about the girls, to leave them in the hands of God. We knew that Cecilia had killed herself because she was a misfit, because the beyond called to her, and we knew that her sisters, once abandoned, felt her calling from that place too. But even as we make these conclusions, we feel our throats plugging up because they are both true and untrue.
Wow. Okay, I hear this, and I feel the way I felt when I read Anne Hornaday's book about movies. Mm-hmm. I had no idea there's so much going on.
Oh, yeah, right? there's a lot going on in this. Okay. There's commentary on, as Michael was just saying, on society and how we view other people when they're going through troubles. You know, there's this, they're talking about the lawn. Everybody wants their lawn to be perfect and the leaves raked perfectly. And when the Lisbon family, as they're kind of spiraling out of control, don't tend to their lawn, everyone's like, what's going on over there? You've got to take care of that, man. And it's just because everyone wants that face for the public that just, hey, everybody's fine. Everybody's fine.
To whom would you recommend it?
Not teenage girls. I don't want you to get any ideas. No, I this is a good, if I were in a high school class, this is a book that I would have wanted to have read. I think there's a lot of ground to cover there. And again, the imagery is very rich, and the style that Eugenides writes with is just lush, you know, mm-hmm. and very, it's very powerful.
Are you glad you read it?
Sure. Sure. Well, no, it's not, I mean, I am. I'm glad I read it because it did spark a lot of thoughts that I haven't had. I mean, it reminded me back of being in English lit class, you know? So
yeah,
you and Michael just
me.
Got a spin off, have your
it's
own
not gonna
show.
It's not going to work for me. I'm just
books
telling you right now.
Well, and speaking of that, Mr.
Next.
Aldridge, you are up next.
By the way, I thought the next one should go to Jeannie since she's not here, and that's what you get when you miss the meeting. You get volunteered for something.
I guess so.
Mark picked on you.
Then I said, what about you? And you said, oh, no.
Ooh.
No. No.
Is this a mystery by chance?
These are not mysteries.
Final Four mystery?
I have a No, sadly no. I don't have a copy of that. Because I brought copies. I'm going to give you this copy for you to borrow. I have your choice. All Quiet on the Western Front.
Uh-huh.
Which is one of the greatest novels written about, it's not a war novel, it's about it's very anti-war.
Mm-hmm.
Or Mr. Kesey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
No. Oh.
Have you read either one of these?
Western Front, I've read.
Oh.
I saw the movie.
Why don't you read?
I'll read Ken
Why don't Kesey. You read One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Sure, why not?
All right, so there's no confusion here. When is his report
When's
due?
When's my report due?
Let me ask you, David, how long would you like to take?
4 or 5 months would be good for me to kind of really get into the oeuvre. Every character.
We'll say within a month. How about that?
Within a month.
Within a month.
February 18th, so by March 18th.
If you miss the date, we'll send Nurse Ratched after you.
Ooh, no kidding.
Come on,
but this
Nurse
is what
Ratched.
Is wrong with society.
What?
My dad, they would give me the book report. They would tell me when it was due, and I would miss the due date. Now, when would you like to have it done, Mr. Aldridge?
You do the same treatment. Would you like to read? Would you like to read All Quiet on the Western Front?
No, that's okay. I'm good. Thank you. All right, moving right along.
I got to sign that right now.
Right along. We're going to go straight to Presidents' Day. We're going to say Books versus Bites for next week.
Fine.
Because you have to read part of the Paris Review thing, and that just takes too long. But let's do, in honor of Presidents' Day, favorite books about presidents. Mark.
You can't have me lead off. I just did the whole book report.
Okay, go straight. Michael?
That's a good point.
I actually don't have one.
What?
This is another one of my gaps. I don't read any nonfiction. So I have read countless bad historical thrillers that involve conspiracies about a number of our presidents.
That could be.
I don't want to share those. I actually would like to compile a list of some good nonfiction to read.
You read those Newt Gingrich books, I bet.
Ah!
Right? I've never read them, but people say they're quite good. I never read the Sean Hannity books, but people say they're actually pretty good. Okay, David. This segment's been faster than we thought.
Maybe we should go to Digital Bites.
People.
Well, see, now I need clarification from the band here.
Okay.
Here's my dilemma. The best book I've ever read about presidents is What It Takes by Richard Ben Cramer, which is just incredible, just amazing.
Pete is nodding.
Right. Psychological study of how someone could possibly believe they have the intelligence, the temperament, the ability to run this country, to be president of the United States. It's a preposterous notion if you think about it. But
even
there's people,
more so today.
Yes, there's people actually think they can do this. And it's about the 1988 presidential campaign. And he follows, I want to say it's six of the top candidates, including Vice President Bush, who became president, who won the election, Michael Dukakis, who was the Democratic nominee, and on and on and on. It's just wonderful, and it's 900 pages. It just takes Bob Dole, the part about the chapters on Bob Dole are just breathtaking, and things you just did not know about Bob Dole and why he is the way he is or why he was the way he was. And it's just incredible detail, incredible knowledge, and they obviously felt comfortable telling him these things that they hadn't told anybody else. So that's my favorite book. Now, having said that, my whole being is formed by reading All the President's Men, which I've
Jeannie
read
were here. That's what
600 times. But
what's that about?
See, but here's the thing. That's the question. I don't think it's
not
about
really
the
about president.
Right. It's not about President Nixon. It's about Woodward and Bernstein.
Yes.
And their process of figuring this story out and the mistakes they made. And it's a wonderful book for any young journalist to read, because if you take away from it, yes, their reporting brought down a president, but they made a ton of mistakes along the way. You know, they made factual errors, they made mistakes in judgment, they did a lot of things wrong, and that's journalism.
Which didn't make it to the movie.
Yeah, well, that's journalism. We get a lot of stuff wrong. You know, the good journalists are the ones that acknowledge that and say, I'll try to do better, you know, so...
But fundamentally changed so much.
Yeah, and it made everybody think that they could be an investigative reporter.
Oh, yeah.
And they really didn't do it the right way, but they, you know, it got done. But that's not really a book about President Nixon. Now, The Final Days, which was their follow-up to that, is about President Nixon, but I don't think it's nearly as well written as All the President's Men, so this is my quandary.
That's a good quandary to have, though.
Mm-hmm.
Choices. Okay. Mine was one of Edmund Morris's books on Roosevelt, but him as a child, which was The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt. And it was more it's just such a fascinating look at that family. Mm-hmm. It's just such a fascinating look at him. You think about him as president, you think he's kind of a wackadoodle. You, as a child, crazy, running around New York, running around Central Park, grabbing animals because he was into taxidermy and he was fascinated with animals. And it's just a ton of fun to read. You just start reading it and you can't stop. So that's my recommendation. Mm-hmm. Now you've thought of one.
I have. Well, I thought I was reading stuff on Warren Harding, but it turned out I was just reading Penthouse Forum Letters.
There you go.
So that didn't count.
I can't believe this happened to me.
But no, actually a couple, and like David, these aren't specifically about a president, but my top of my list is The 13 Days, which is written by Robert Kennedy.
Sure. Yeah.
And because it gives you an insight into, obviously, one of the scariest events in the last, 150 years, maybe ever, and sort of the blow-by-blow report of that, at least from his perspective. And that sort of glimpse inside the power structure, to me, was fascinating. But I'm also a big Hunter S. Thompson guy, so I love Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, because I just sort of love the meat and guts, and the way he attacks stuff just really appealed to me. So
excellent choices.
Can I give an honorable mention?
Certainly, of course.
The Path to Power by Robert Carroll.
Always.
The second volume about Lyndon Johnson, and it's about the 1948 Senate race in Texas, which he stole. They created votes that didn't exist, and he stole it. But what I always think about is that if not for Lyndon Johnson blatantly stealing an election, there would have been no Civil Rights Act. There would have been no Voting Rights Act. And you think about these things, and sadly, if President Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, there would have been none of this would have happened.
Yeah.
And you just think about all these things that had to happen for that to happen.
I think for people who really want to learn something, the Carroll books can't be beaten.
Ugh.
Can't be beaten.
Ugh.
They're incredible.
So well good. So
okay.
well done.
Do we take a break before we officially go to Pete?
Yes, we will take
now
a break.
Now we're going to take a break.
Yes. So everybody, finish your beers and then order another one, and we'll be right back with Pete
Dustin's
Souza.
Dustin's looking very busy.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books.
Are you allowed to name the band?
This is a band called Production Music.
It's lovely.
No, the song we played earlier to test the sound system, that's The Lively Exchange.
Okay.
Dustin Merkel and The Lively Exchange.
Kind of similar.
Yeah, I suppose so. And they'll be on Tony's show tomorrow.
Great. Thank you again. We're just a warm-up.
There you go.
We are back with Chatter on Books. We are at Chatter at the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer, which has been doing a lively business all day here today for President's Day. God bless you all. Mm-hmm. And Pete Souza, thank you so much for being with us. I've watched about 50 of the interviews you've done, read about 45 of the interviews you have done.
Sorry.
And every one of them enjoyable. I think most people know you have your fan club, which is large. You have two fabulous books, one, Obama, an Intimate Portrait, and then this one right in front of me, Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents. I think most people know you were a White House photographer for many years for President Obama. I doubt many people know you worked for President Reagan before that in the Reagan photo office, and before that a Chicago Trib photographer, and that is how you first met then-Senator Obama. But you were a journalism major back at K-State. Did you always want to be a photographer, or were you going to be Woodward and Bernstein?
I actually went to undergrad at Boston University, and I wanted to become a sports writer, believe it or not.
Well, just stay here till tomorrow morning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
you can do that. But I took a photography class my junior year of college at BU. What kind of
camera was it? We have some photographers out here.
It was probably an old Canon. I went back and forth between Canon and Nikon over the years. So I think it was a Canon at the time. And the bug hit me right away, and I knew that's what I wanted to do. It took me many years to get halfway decent at it. I ended up going to grad school at Kansas State University, and they had a great daily college newspaper, which is really where I learned how to become a photojournalist.
I briefly worked for a guy running for Congress out there once. What's the name of the newspaper, K-State?
It was called The Collegian.
Yeah. And what kinds of things did you shoot for them that got you started?
Everything from sports, news, feature, whatever was going on.
So one of the things that fascinates me about this book that we have in front of us, Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, is most people, when they think about photographers, they think about White House photographers in particular. They think about you are not visible. You're a fly on the wall. You're faded into the wallpaper. All of those cliches about the photographer just isn't seen or heard from. And I think that suits a lot of photographers. David, you've worked with a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
It suits their personality. A lot of photographers that I know, dear friends, tend to be more introverted. And that personality trait works really well for photographers. So your first book, The Intimate Portrait of President Obama, kind of a classic White House photographer's book. And then this, some months ago, when the current guy is in the White House, he starts to do some things that tick you off. And it makes you remember certain things that President Obama did when he was president. You think of a photograph, and you started putting them out there on Instagram. And you juxtapose the two events, the 2 minutes, if you will, in the two different presidents, and put a very, very concise, wonderful caption next to it. And you started becoming one of President Trump's biggest trolls and throwing shade. When you started that on Instagram a few years ago, did you know what trolling was? Did you know what throwing shade was?
I mean, I knew what trolling was. I didn't know the term throwing shade, to be honest with you.
You didn't know you were so hip.
I did not know I was so hip. I had to kind of look it up to see what it meant. I mean, I knew, obviously, what I was doing. I just didn't know that it was called throwing shade.
So the three questions I saw you being asked most often in all those interviews, how you got your job, were there ever times, were there events or incidents in which you wouldn't take a picture because of what was going on, whether it was a matter of state or a personal matter for the family, and what was going through your head when you took the famous picture of President Obama and his national security team watching them take down Osama bin Laden. So we won't ask those.
Oh, I was getting ready to like...
You're already
No, we're not going to ask those. I'm going to ask...
I like some wild cards. So if you have some wild cards, that's great.
Oh, my husband had a long list of them. I said, no, that's too mean. No, that's too embarrassing. No, we're not going to do those kinds of things. Brian's here.
Yes, he's right outside if we want to bring him back.
What was it that the current occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue did that got you to first come out of the typical shell of a photographer and start putting these photos out on Instagram with the captions? Was there a day, was there a moment, or did it just kind of build up and one day you said, oh, come on? Did it start at the very beginning with the... the inaugural address?
There are two things happened. One, I have to say that January 20th, 2017 was kind of a surreal day. Just the very nature of it, the address. And on that day, right after the inauguration, I flew with then former President Obama to California, where he was going to go on vacation with Michelle for a week. And the outgoing president gets to use Air Force One last time. So we flew out to California, dropped him off, and I flew back on an almost empty plane with maybe a dozen of us. There were maybe a dozen of us on the plane coming back. And I ended up getting home like 5:30 in the morning. So I missed the whole controversy on the crowd size. And it wasn't until the next day that I started getting caught up on what had happened. And when Sean Spicer came out and just lied from the podium, I was like, this ain't right. There's something wrong with this, where on day one, the press secretary is being ordered to lie about a crowd size. That does not bode very well for this administration. And then I think it was that day that there was a photograph released of the Oval Office with the ornate gold curtains and President Obama and I think every other president before him had an American flag and a presidential flag. And Trump had like six presidential flags and six American flags. And I was appalled. And I think the first picture I posted that you would call shade was a picture of President Obama sitting on the Resolute desk, and I think my caption was something like, kind of like the old curtains better.
Yeah.
And people caught on, even though I didn't really know what I was doing.
But you knew to put it on Instagram.
But I knew to put it on Instagram. And
there you go. There is a thread through this book and through a lot of your work since you've left the White House, I'm completely in the tank for Pete Souza if people haven't figured this out by now. It's the respect for the office. Clearly, you had an incredible relationship with President Obama, but I think it is as much or more your work now is about respect for the office of the presidency.
Well, and I think it actually helped that I was a White House photographer for President Reagan for 5.5 years, because I don't look at this as a partisan endeavor. It's more of, I just think the current president disrespects the office. He doesn't believe in the rule of law. He bullies people. He lies to us all the time. And to me, that's just a disgrace for this office. And that's why I'm speaking out. It's not because he's a Republican and President Obama was a Democrat. It has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and most White House photographers are very apolitical, tend to be very. What was it like shooting for President Reagan versus shooting for President Obama?
It's hard. They were 25 years apart, these two jobs.
Because you
that I
started
had.
Shooting for President Reagan when you were 5.
I was in my 20s. Yeah, no, I said I was 12 earlier, but let's be honest, I was in my 20s. And Reagan, was in his 70s, so he was older. I didn't have a relationship with him coming in. His chief photographer, Michael Evans, hired me to work under him. So it was just a different time. It was a different era. He was very old-fashioned in a way,
but appreciated
in an 80s kind
the
of way.
Value of a good still photo.
I think so.
Yeah.
I think he did. I think he understood the value of having someone there documenting his presidency for history. I don't know that our access is quite as good as the kind of access I had
right.
for President Obama or Yoshi Okamoto had for LBJ or Kennedy Lee had with Ford. But it was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, certainly better than I think what we're seeing now in terms of like behind the scenes moments. But it was a different era, you know. I mean, this is CNN didn't even get started until 1984.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So basically, you had the three networks and the New York Times and Washington Post as the media covering the White House. And, you know, compare it to when President Obama was in office and, you know, you got a million cable TV stations, social media, and it was just a different era.
Yep. Well, I promised my husband I wouldn't go, and I promised the students from AU who were here I wouldn't go through every single photograph, but I am going to go through several of them that are, again, not the ones that every other interviewer asked you about. There's a Halloween picture on page 133, if you're following along with the books out there, page 133, in which President Obama and Michelle Obama are looking down. A little kid has shown up for the White House Halloween party in a Pope mobile. Do you remember this one?
Oh, yeah, I remember
this.
That
is spectacular. Yeah. Now,
this was right after Pope Francis had visited the White House, not long after. I think he visited in, I can't remember if it was that month or September of that year. And then, you know, and you could see that President Obama was just, you know, he's cracking up.
It's cracking
up. He's like, look at this, Michelle.
It is worth cracking
up.
Now,
I got a funny story is when I did a book signing at Kramer Books. I had to think for a second there.
Yeah.
And she came.
No, that kid?
Yeah, the kid came with the
great. Yeah, with the Pope hat on.
Yeah, I did pictures with her and everything.
That's awesome.
God bless the parents of this kid, by the way. No. Michael, take notes here. Not that you'll dress your kid up as a Pope, but there's a little Pope hat, little Pope dress, gown, a Pope mobile, and down to the little red shoes. Remember the red Italian shoes?
Sure.
Okay, that's page 133. Now, if you're following along, and there are two stories to this, Stormy. Beautiful picture of the White House, dark clouds, very stormy day. Mm-hmm. And there are two stories to this, but they're your stories, Pete, so go ahead.
I don't...
Want me to read the captions on the
other
side?
No, I know the captions. The this was at a time when Trump was dealing with the whole Stormy Daniels affair and, you know, that he didn't pay her off. Then he admitted that he paid her off. Then he said it wasn't a legal campaign contribution. And so I just posted the picture of the Stormy White House with the caption Stormy. And that's, I mean, one of the beauties of Instagram was just making people think about what I was doing. Like, you'd have to be paying attention to the news in order to know what my Instagram was referring to. In the book, it's obvious because I've drawn the line between either a Trump tweet or a news headline and what I had posted on Instagram. Now, I do want to point out that if you take the cover of the book off, the
dust
jacket...
Those of you following along outside, take the cover of your book off.
It is also on the on the actual hard cover of the book.
A fight with your publisher?
Well, see, you have been reading. It wasn't necessarily a fight. It's just that I really wanted that picture to be the cover. And I think the publisher made a good point. Bill Clinton and James Patterson had just released a mystery book and had a similar picture of the White House on the cover. And they thought people might be confused about what my book was actually about.
I think your publisher was looking out for your safety and security
more than that.
But it's a great compromise that you got them to put it on the cover of the book itself, under the dust jacket. That's great. Okay, my absolute favorite, and I have not seen anybody ask you about this or talk about it, but it's on page 181, if you're following along, and it is a picture of Stevie Wonder touching the bust of Martin Luther King in the Oval Office, I'm guessing. And what's remarkable about this to me, it's a beautiful photograph, is if you are a White House photographer, if you're the president's photographer, you're focused on him. You're watching him every second to get the great moment. This was the greatest moment, I'm sure, in that meeting, and you got it. Do you remember taking that photo?
Yeah, no, I do remember. But the Stevie Wonder was going to do a concert that night at the White House, and President Obama invited him into the Oval Office for a quick sit-down meeting. And was telling him about the bust and walked him over to the bust. And I have I do have a shot back the way where you can see both of them. But then I saw his hand feeling the MLK bus, and that's when I went in and kind of zoomed in and zoomed in on the hand. Because to me, that sort of, even though you couldn't necessarily maybe tell it was Stevie Wonder, I think people got it.
Yeah, absolutely. David.
When did, I'm so in awe of photographers who capture things, and I always wonder when you realize that you weren't just taking pictures, that you were telling stories.
Well, I mean, I always looked at the job as, you know, you're trying to document the presidency for history. Mm-hmm. And I think what that means is really dependent upon the particular president and his or her photographer, because someday there'll be a her. And with President Obama, he understood the value of having me document his presidency. He also trusted me enough to give me essentially access to everything. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was trying to find, I call them these small moments that may not necessarily be from big historic events, but everyday occurrences that help tell you what he is like as a person, as a mm-hmm. human being. So those are the pictures that meant the most to me and still mean the most to me, more so than, you know, the Bin Laden photo or things like that. Those are historic photos. They're important for history. But for me, it was just a lot of times it was just the way he would interact with other people and trying to capture those little moments that show you. I mean, imagine if we had a set of pictures like I did with President Obama of Abraham Lincoln,
right?
You know, and so and the great thing about all the White House official White House photographers, all of our work, every single picture is saved, and is now at the National Archives. So for years to come, people will be able to go back and look through my pictures. If you go to the Reagan Library website right now, you can look at every single proof sheet I ever, I ever took, every mm-hmm. single picture I ever took. And in due time, that will happen with all my Obama pictures. I don't know that anybody's going to want to go through 1.9 million photos, but if
that
they
the
do,
number?
That's how many I shot.
Wow. That's amazing.
Holy cow. Wow. I think it really does. Often with presidents or politicians at that level, near that level, often people who know them really well say, well, the public image isn't the same if you really mm-hmm. knew the guy. People said that about Hillary Clinton endlessly. Now, if you really knew the real person. Bush 41, a lot of us talked about this when he passed recently. Oh, if you'd known the guy, he was funny, he was kind, so respectful of the office of the presidency. That was the core of every belief in him. But that didn't come across, and mm-hmm. he didn't allow people to do the things. I think in your work when you did it when he was president, and certainly in this, in Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, you see him allowing you to photograph him in very informal settings, clearly engaging with his wife, with his children, with little kids. Some of the pictures of him sitting on little chairs with little kids are just remarkable. Was he smart to do that? And or is he just a nice guy and it wouldn't occur to him to say, well, as President Reagan did. President Reagan had a different way of looking at these things, saying, no, that's not an appropriate time to be taking photographs.
No, I mean, he didn't really, there were no restrictions on what or, you know, what I could or couldn't shoot.
Did he ever throw you out?
Did he ever throw me out? I wouldn't say throw me out. I mean, I came to learn that if he was having a one-on-one meeting with someone, he wouldn't want me in there the whole time, right? Sure. And, you know, and it was sort of like a dance. Like, I'd figure out, I'd want to get my pictures and make sure I've got, you know, good pictures, and then I'd kind of just back out of the room. And I'd be lingering nearby so that when the meeting broke up, oftentimes that's when the most interesting pictures happen, when they're standing in the middle of the Oval Office or they're, getting ready to walk out the door. There's kind of those last interactions, mm-hmm. and I'd always, you know, come back in for those. Same thing with his daughters. I can't even remember if it's in this book, but it was in the Obama Intimate Portrait book. There's a picture of him with Malia. They're on the swing set together right outside the Oval Office, and it's a very intimate picture. It's just the two of them. There's nobody else around, And you know, in a situation like that, you just sort of feel intuitively, okay, I've got my picture, now I'm going to back away and let them have, you know, their privacy. They want to have a father-daughter talk,
right.
And I don't need to be there intruding on that. And it's those are just things that you sort of feel more than him saying, hey, Pete, get the hell out of here.
And you've built up a level of trust,
right.
A level of knowing each other. But that's pretty extraordinary. And Kennerly had that. Here's David Kennerly, who's a mutual friend of ours, who's a fantastic photographer. I actually think, Pete, he is a better photographer now than he was 30 years ago.
You know, the thing I appreciate about Kennerly is even like yesterday, he posted some pictures just walking around Santa Monica.
Right, right.
He's always shooting new pictures, which, you know, I really appreciate. Sometimes it's with his iPhone. Sometimes it's with his Canon DSLR, you know.
But he had that same level of trust with Gerald Ford. And
he
there are some remarkably intimate photos of Ford and what he went through. Okay, so what's next for you? And I don't know at what point in your Instagram rock star status you started changing. It became hashtag throw shade, then vote. So there is something more important, not more important, but as important for you now.
Well, that was kind of
leading active.
Yeah, that was kind of leading up to the midterm elections. You know, I think everybody understands now that too many people stayed home in 2016 on election day. And I think people now understand that was a mistake, that if you want to affect change, you have to do your civic duty and get out and vote. So before the midterms, I was just, you know, doing my little tiny part to encourage people to get out and vote in the midterms.
So are you an activist who happens to be a photographer, or you're a photographer who happens to be an activist?
I am a truth teller. I am a truth teller. That's the way I look at myself.
Nice. So what's next for the truth teller?
The truth teller has several different projects in the works that are some will definitely come to fruition, and some may or may not come to fruition.
It's kind of like life. It's kind of life.
Yeah,
It is just a thrill to have you here. Again, I have to really resist the temptation to go through this book page by page and ask you about every single one, which I will not do. But, Mark, we're going to do something historic here, which is we may almost end on time. And, Pete, something we do at the end of every show is we give what we call the desert/deserted island recommendation, in which if you're going to go to a deserted or desert island and could only take one book, what it would be. For you, we'll start with somebody else, but for you, I think we should ask, if and you can pick both or either, one book, or if you could only take one photograph with you.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be yours or somebody else's, but you ponder for a minute. Michael, I know you are primed and ready with your book recommendation.
I'm recommending Jabari Jumps.
Well, hold on. We're gonna take a break.
Oh, my God. I keep forgetting.
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Take a break.
Yeah, we'll get back to that.
I'm no longer recommending Jabari Jumps.
No, it's ruined for him.
Jabari has already jumped.
Jabari's jumped. But
it's a sequel.
That recommendation and all of ours is coming up right after this.
How could I have forgotten?
I know. You can't do the deserted island without...
Hakuna Matata, isn't it?
Without the
we do need... What's the stuff you said that looks like this bottle?
Malibu.
Oh, my God.
Malibu. Shots of Malibu for everybody after the show.
Woo! On Mark.
I believe last we were on the show, Michael was about to give us a recommendation.
Yes, I'm still recommending Jabari Jumps. I don't want to mispronounce the author's name. I think it's Gaia Cornwall. This is a children's book, and we've been reading this a lot to Walker. And what I love about this is the watercolor stylings really work quite well, as we see Jabari, a young boy who goes to the pool with his father. And off the bat, I just love that it's a dad taking his two young kids to the pool. And Jabari is a great jumper. He wants to tell his dad how great of a jumper he is. When he finally gets to the big diving jump, he's not as good of a jumper as he might have thought. And it perfectly captures those moments when you're afraid of something and your dad gives you the encouragement to do it without just saying, I know you're afraid, let's handle this. So Jabari gets up there and he has all these hemming and hawings about, well, I didn't do my stretches. So his dad, well, come on down, we can always do this later. So he finally gets up there and his dad goes, I want you to look at this as a surprise. Jabari loves surprises. So when he finally gets up, there's this beautiful shot and you see the city in the background and he's about to jump and he closes his eyes and just says, I love surprises. And it's... Walker
nice.
Loves it. I think it's mostly the colors.
The colors are lovely.
And it just makes me, I want to be the kind of dad who can help Walker get through those obstacles without being so transparent about what's happening, and I love introducing metaphor in such a fun way for my kid.
Nice. Nicely done.
That's beautiful.
Mark?
I'm going to go the other direction. I'm going to go a book about revenge.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Love it.
This is one of my favorite books.
For when Walker's
Count 20. Of Monte Cristo?
Count of Monte Cristo.
Yes!
They say
love it.
Revenge is a dish best served cold. But I don't think the Count serves it cold. He just serves it up and serves
just
it
waits.
Nice.
Yeah. He just waits.
Yeah, Alexandre Dumas. It's
just, that's awesome.
I've got a bunch of his books at my house. It's some that I have not read. You know, he wrote a sequel to the Three Musketeers called like 20 Years Later. And it's just them 20 years after, and they're sort of old and fat. And how
you can never put the band back together again.
Yeah, so I want to get to that. But this is one of my all-time favorite books. And if you've never read it, don't say, I've seen the movie. No. This is
read
one you got to read.
Yeah. Good one.
It's just fantastic.
I agree.
Fantastic.
Good
yes.
one. I agree.
Love you nailed that, David.
That was great. I love that. No, I'll wait. I love that. No, I'll wait.
I got a plan. It's going to be great when it all comes
David.
Together.
I'm running out of books, Tori. I'm not that smart.
It's all right.
It's a biography. It's an autobiography, actually. It's a pseudo autobiography by a man named Peter Brown, who had access, who was one of the managers of the Beatles, in the book's called The Love You Make.
Yes, I have read this.
It's just a great book about the Beatles.
It's fantastic.
And how crazy and insane their lives were. And it has an affair, and that's all I'm going to say.
Just one?
Well, one significant one.
There are some amazing stories that come out of that.
Yeah.
And by the way, if anybody's heard the song The Ballad of John and Yoko, Peter Brown is referencing that because he was sort of helping him get through Gibraltar and do the marriage and all
genius
that kind of
could
stuff.
Be
it's a fantastic
one.
Book.
Oh,
it's
amazing.
It's got
yes.
all this insight. It's just
wholeheartedly
great.
Agree.
Just great.
It's fantastic.
Pete, do you have one yet? And or a photo?
Well, the what's interesting is I read mostly nonfiction. But, in thinking about Desert Island, the first book that I ever read, I think it was in seventh grade, I was not a good reader. I never wanted to read a book. And in seventh grade, I read The Yearling, which is like
I'm
more
totally
than 50
in
years
love.
Ago.
Sure. My love affair
and
is
And I could
confirmed.
Not put that book down. That was that was my real introduction to reading.
Excellent.
And I haven't read it since that, seventh grade.
Yeah.
So I think I'd want to reread that.
I think if you picked it up tomorrow, you would love it. I think I have reread it, and I think you would love it. That would stay with you. Is there one photograph, if you could only take one photograph with you? It's kind of like asking somebody, which child do you like the best?
I think I would take the photograph by a NASA astronaut on the moon of Earthrise.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Oh,
that's a great one.
Good one.
68, right? Yeah. Christmas Day or whatever.
Good
I think
one.
That's a good one.
By the way, speaking of famous photographs, did you guys know the news today? The sailor in the kiss
yes.
on VJ Day. His name was George Mendonca.
Yeah.
Passed away today.
2 days before his birthday.
I did not know they figured out who it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It took
yeah.
them decades.
Yeah, but that is... I mean, does that stand out for you as like one of the an iconic photographs?
Sure, that was a picture was taken by Alfred Eisenstadt, who
oh, really?
Was a Life magazine photographer. Yeah,
but it took them decades to figure out who it was.
And I think also figure out who the nurse was.
Too. Right, Greta right. Zimmer,
or was it a nurse or was it
a dental assistant in a nurse's uniform? Yeah, yeah. yeah. But if there's a moment that captures just the essence of that.
That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, it's hard to top that or Pete's, but I'll do it anyhow. So Valerie Condos Field, most people don't know the name. She's the coach of the UCLA women's gymnastics team.
Okay.
And a few weeks ago, there was this incredible video which went viral.
Oh, yeah.
One of the young ladies,
the gymnast,
right?
Yes,
yeah, she's
yes.
okay.
Yes.
And, yeah, she's okay.
She's brilliant.
If you like that sort of thing.
And this woman, who they all call Miss Val, is extraordinary. She didn't have a gymnastics background when she became coach of the team. She had come from dance and things like that. But under her tutelage, 7 NCAA championships, breast cancer survivor, and she's written a book which is called, and she's retiring because she says, I've got some other things I want to do.
The book called What Have You Done?
Yeah, exactly. Life is short, don't wait to dance.
Oh, that's great.
And she has wonderful John Madden stories in her office.
Awesome.
She has some old chair that used to be John Madden's, and she used him for a lot of inspiration.
That's great.
And it is a wonderful book. And Mark, it is 6:29.
Look at that.
We're
Boom.
Finishing, yeah.
Look at that.
Okay, well, we're I cannot say enough about Pete Souza. I may have to kidnap him so I can ask him all the questions. But Pete, thank you so much for being with us.
Pete.
If you do not have the book Shade, A Tale of Two Presidents, or the other one, Obama, An Intimate Portrait, you should get them. It will make, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or completely apolitical, it will make you feel good about the presidency and the White House.
What do we got coming up next week?
Speaking of, we have Mark Salter, longtime aide and co-author of 7 books with John McCain.
Oh, wow.
God rest his soul. And Mark Salter is a remarkable person, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful writer. And he is going to come in, and I promised him we wouldn't spend the entire time talking about John McCain. And we will revisit our conflicting stories about how Mark Salter first got the job with John McCain, which involved me and a bar in New Orleans.
Ooh.
But I'll leave it at that.
Can't wait to hear those stories.
Yep.
Until then, thank you, everybody, for
tuning
in.
Thanks, everybody, for coming
out. Thanks, everybody, coming to Chatter.
Thank you,
thank you, Dustin.
Yes, we'll be back here next week at 5:30. We'll see you guys then.